shall this peace treaty be broken, however things betide. No force of circumstance make me swerve from it of my own free will, not even though a flood should melt all earth into sea, and heaven be dissolved in hell. As sure as this scepter of mine, which I hold in my right hand, never could put out new shoots and be dressed in light leaves to give men shade, once it was cut away from low down on its parent tree in the forest, shedding its twigs and foliage to the knife. It was a growing thing, but the hand of a craftsman encased it in elegant bronze and made it the scepter of the kings of Latium. So, in full view of the princes assembled, they ratify the treaty between them in these terms. Then are the ceremonial victims solemnly sacrificed, hard by the fires, their living entrails torn out, and the altars loaded with high-piled dishes. But for some time the Italians had been in a vacillating, uneasy state of mind, thinking the fight an unfair one. All the more now, when they saw from close up that the principals were not equally matched for it. Turnus heightened the feeling, as mutely he went to the altar and humbly worshipped with downcast eyes. They noticed how pale he was too, how wasted his cheeks had become. As soon as his sister Juturna perceived that the mutterings of unrest were growing, that public opinion was wavering and irresolute, into the crowd she moved, assuming the likeness of Camers, a man of distinguished family, whose father was widely renowned for his valour, and who was himself a most active soldier. She went into the ranks of the Rutuli, a definite plan in her head, and started a whispering campaign with remarks like this. "Aren't you ashamed, you Italians, at risking one hero's life to save an army like ours? Are we not equal in numbers and strength to the foe? Arcadians and Trojans? Look, they are all there, with the doom-ridden Etruscans intent upon Turnus' death. Why, if half of us fought them, they'd hardly have men to equal us. Turnus shall mount on wings of fame to the gods whose altars he vows his life to, and live on the lips of men for ever. But we shall lose our country and have to obey those arrogant masters because we choose to sit here now and do nothing." More and more did these words inflame the mood of resentment among the Rutulian soldiers. Muttering crept through the ranks. Even the Laurentines and Latins began to change their attitude. Men who'd been dreaming of rest from the struggle, of going about their affairs in peace, now wanted to fight, prayed that the treaty be void, and felt pity for Turnus in his unfair predicament. Here Juturna threw in a heavier weight, a delusive portent, giving a sign from the skies above, which worked on the minds of the Italians more strongly than anything else. A golden eagle, Jupiter's bird, aloft in the red sky, was chasing a pack of waterfowl, which uttered clamorous sounds as they flew before it. Suddenly, swooping down to the water, it greedily seized a magnificent swan in its hook-like claws. The Italians grew tense as they watched. Now the whole flock of waterfowl wheeled from their flight, screaming, a regular marvel to see, and darkening the sky with their wings, closed up, a cloud of them, mobbed the eagle, and drove it before them, until, overborne by their fury and the sheer weight of its burden, it weakened, dropping the victim into the river below, and fled to the cover of a cloud. This, of course, the Rutulians hailed with shouts as an augury. Their hands flew to their sword-hilts. Tolumnius, the augur, at once cried, This was what I have often prayed for. I mark and acknowledge this sign from above. Out with your swords and follow me, you downtrodden folk, whom like a flock of birds at his mercy a greedy adventurer terrorizes and violently plunders your coasts. Now he'll have to fly, sail far away and take cover out on the deep. Close up your ranks, then, with one accord, and fight to defend the prince whom that bird of prey has seized. So saying, he ran forward and launched a weapon right at the foe. His spear of cornel wood cut through the air, whining, accurate in aim. At once a great roar went up. All the rows of spectators broke out in a frenzy of uncontrollable passion. That spear flew on. Now it happened 9 brothers stood in its path. Young men of splendid physique, all were the sons of Arcadian Gylippus by one faithful wife, an Etruscan woman. One of these, a handsome fellow in shining armor, was hit by the spear at his waist, where his stomach was chafed by the belt heavily sewn at the buckle which clasped it tightly together. It skewered him through the ribs and laid him dead on the brown sand. His brothers, crazy with grief, brave as they come, in a body charged at the foe head down, unsheathing their swords or snatching up iron-tipped javelins. The army of the Laurentines ran forward to meet them, and then, once again, streamed forth a great flood of Trojans, of Cyretans, and Arcadians with blazoned arms. All are devoured by one passion, to fight it out with the sword. The altars stood dismantled. A whirling barrage of missiles darkened the sky like a storm cloud. The blizzard of iron grew thicker. The bowls and the fires were removed from the altars. Latinus himself, now the treaty was void, picked up the images of his defeated gods and fled. Men harnessed their chariot horses or leapt astride their chargers and raced with drawn swords to the fray. Messapus, eager to tear up the treaty, rode at Orestes, a Tuscan king, who bore the insignia of his kingship, and frightened him into recoiling. Orestes, reeling backwards, unluckily tumbled over an altar behind him and fell on his head and shoulders. Messapus was up to him in a flash with his lance, and towering above him on horseback, fiercely stabbed down at him, for all his entreaties, with the massive weapon, and cried, "He's had it! This best of victims I've sacrificed to the gods!" The Italians ran to the spot and despoiled the still warm corpse. As Ebesus came at him, ready to strike, Corineus, full in his path, snatched up a red-hot brand from an altar and thrust the blaze of it into his face. The man's great beard caught fire and gave off a smell of singeing. Corineus followed it up by gripping the hair of his dazed antagonist in his left hand, bringing a knee up against him and thrusting him hard to the ground, then slashed him in the side with his tempered blade. Podalirius bore down with uplifted sword on Alsus the shepherd, just as he charged through the missiles there in the front rank. Alsus, however, swung back his axe and bisected his enemy's head from brow to chin, so that his armor was spattered with blood all over. Unkind repose, the iron sleep weighed down Podalirius' eyes. His eyelids closed for everlasting night. But Aeneas the true, his head unhelmeted, put out his right hand, which held no weapon, and shouted appeals to his own comrades. "Where are you off to? Why this sudden outbreak of violence? Pull yourselves together. The truce has been made, and its terms are all fixed now. I am the only man who's allowed to fight. Leave it to me, and no more of this panicking. I will confirm the pact with my arms. The rites we've performed make Turnus my business." Even as he spoke, before he'd finished appealing, an arrow, imagine it, winged its way towards him, whizzing. Nobody knows who drew the bowstring, who sent that arrow flying, who won, whether by accident or heavenly aid, such glory for the Italians. No one claimed the renown for so splendid a feat, or ever boasted of having wounded Aeneas. When Turnus saw Aeneas retire from the field, and his officers gravely disturbed, with a sudden access of glowing confidence he called for his weapons and horses, proudly leapt up at one bound into his chariot, and fought to control the plunging team. Then, careering about the field, he killed many brave warriors, bowled many over, mortally wounded, knocked down whole ranks with his chariot wheels, sent a quick fire of spears at the fleeing enemy. As, by the banks of icy Hebrus, ensanguined Mars, driving his horses at full pelt, clangs out on his shield the alarum of war. The horses are furiously galloping over the broad plains, faster than south wind or west. Their drumming hooves make the furthest regions of Thrace reverberate. Fear, with its lowering visage, angers and stratagems, speed on in the train of the war god. Exultant as this now, Turnus is lashing on through the battle, his horses streaming with sweat. He tramples over the horribly slaughtered foe, while showers of blood fly out from beneath the galloping hooves as they stamp the sand into bloody paste. Thenelus now he killed, Thamyrus, Pholus, the first from a distance, the other two at close quarters. He killed with spear casts the sons of Imbrasus, Glaucus and Lardes, brought up by their father in Lycia. He had equipped them with arms equally suitable for close fighting on foot or charging on wind-swift horses. On another sector, Eumedes hurled himself into the fighting, the war-famed son of that Dolon widely renowned of old, having his grandsire's name, the courage and strength of his father, who once, for venturing into the Danaan camp as a spy, demanded that his reward should be nothing less than Achilles' horses. But Diomed gave him a very different reward for his daring. A dead man cannot aspire to the team of Achilles. Well, Turnus noticed Eumedes far off on the open plain, and hitting him first with a long-range javelin shot, drove over, pulled up his pair of horses, leapt down from the chariot, straddled the fallen, dying man, and putting his foot hard down on his neck, twisted the sword out of his hand to plunge its glittering blade deep into his throat. Then spoke these words: "Lie there! Measure out with your length, you Trojan, the land of Hesperia you wanted to grab by aggression. This is the payoff they get, who dare to take arms against me. Thus do they found their city." Then, hurling his spear, he sent Asbutes to keep him company, Chloreus and Sybaris, Thersilochus and Dares, Thymoetes too, who had fallen, pitched over his horse's head. As when a northerly gale from Thrace is roaring over the Aegean, and driving shorewards rank upon rank of waves, and clouds go flying in the sky where squalls of wind have flailed them, so the formations give way, the ranks turn round and run, wherever Turnus cleaves a path, carried on by his own momentum, his plumes fluttering in the wind of the chariot's passage. Phegeus, enraged at this onset, and Turnus arrogant shouting, now threw himself in the chariot's path, and seizing the foam-flecked bridles of the frenzied horses, he wrenched them off their course. As gripping the yoke he was dragged along, the broad-bladed lance of Turnus found his unshielded side, broke through the joint of his corselet where it was thrust, and gave him a slight flesh wound. But Phegeus turned on his foe, shield up, and was trying to get at him, to draw his sword and make a fight of it, when the wheel, with the impetus of the hurtling chariot behind it, sent him spinning and crashed him to earth. Turnus at once followed up with a sword slash between the helmet's lower rim and the top of the corselet, which took off his head and left his trunk on the sand. Now, while the victorious Turnus littered the battlefield with dead, Aeneas, bleeding, was helped into camp by his best friend, Achates, and by Nicias, Ascanius beside them. He leant heavily on his tall spear at every other step. Bitterly chagrined he was. He strove to pluck out the head of the broken arrow, told them to give him a rough and ready treatment, to cut out the barb with a sword, open up the flesh where it was lodged so deep, and get him back into the fighting. At this point, Iapis, the son of Iasus, came up. This man was specially dear to Apollo, who, seized by intense passion for him, had delightedly offered him once his own arts, his own powers, of divination, of music, of shooting the swift-flying arrow. Iapis, to lengthen the life of a father desperately ill, elected the knowledge of healing herbs, the science of medicine, choosing to practice an art which has little status in obscurity. Aeneas, chafing and fuming, stood there propped on his giant spear, a great crowd of soldiers about him, with young Ascanius grieving, himself unmoved by their tears. Now the aged Iapis, with sleeves rolled up and gown close girdled, as doctors have them, rapidly tried many methods, applying the curative herbs of Apollo. But all were useless, and vainly too did he work to coax the arrowhead out of the wound in the grip of his forceps. Fortune gave him no clue, nor did his patron Apollo assist him, and all the time the terrible roar of battle was mounting, disaster nearing. The fighters saw no sky but a canopy of dust. The enemy horsemen charged closer, and missiles fell thickly right in the camp. The din of warriors fighting and falling as they struggled went hideously up to the heavens. Now Venus, greatly distressed by her son's unmerited suffering, with a mother's solicitude plucked from Ida in Crete a root of dittany, full grown, with down on its leaves and a crimson flower. The plant is one not unfamiliar to wild goats, which get relief from it when they've been stuck by an arrow. Putting a veil of mist around her, the goddess brought this herb and made an infusion of it in a cauldron, with sparkling water. None saw her doing it, adding drops of the juice of health-giving ambrosia and fragrant panacea. The aged Iapis bathed the wound with that infusion, quite unaware of its provenance. At once, as might be expected, the pain all went, and the flow of blood from the deep wound stopped. So, then, the barb came away in his hand. No force was needed, and fell out. Aeneas' strength was renewed. He was strong as ever. Iapis immediately roused up their fighting spirit by shouting, "Jump to it! Fetch our commander his weapons! Don't stand about there! This cure has been brought to pass by no human means, no medical mastery of mine! It is not my skill that has saved you, Aeneas. One greater, a god, is behind it, restores you for deeds yet greater." Aeneas, thirsting for battle, irked by delay, had put on his golden greaves, left leg, right leg. Now he brandished his spear. As soon as the corselet was on, and the shield at his side in position, he folded his son Ascanius in a mailed embrace, and lightly kissing his lips through the helmet's open visor, he said, "From me you may learn courage and what real effort is, from others the meaning of fortune. Today this hand will see you're protected in war, and take you to where war's prizes are found. Be sure that, when you have grown to your full manhood, you do not forget, but rather, dwelling upon your kinsman's example, be inspired by your father Aeneas, your uncle Hector." When he had spoken, Aeneas sallied forth in his might, shaking his massive spear, Antheus and Nestheus with him, a close-packed column of warriors rapidly moving forwards and leaving the camp deserted. Then was the plain a flurry of blinding dust, and the ground thrilled with the tramp of feet. Turnus, upon a rampart opposite, saw them advancing. The Italians saw it, and tremors of icy fear pervaded their inmost hearts. Before any of the Latins, Juturna heard that marching sound, and knew what it meant, and fled in terror. Aeneas raced on, his column sweeping and darkening the plain. As when a storm has burst, and a cyclone strides across the sea towards the land, and forewarned from afar, the hearts of poor countrymen are appalled, that storm is going to fell their trees and flatten their growing crops, create havoc everywhere. Gusts blowing in from the sea trumpet the gale's approach. So did the Trojan commander launch a frontal attack on the enemy, with his men all rallying to him, compact in arrowhead formations. Thymbrius struck down big Osiris, Nestheus killed Arcetius, Achates killed Epulo, Gaius killed Ufens, even the augur Tolumnius fell. he who had been the first to fire at the Trojan ranks. A din rose up to the sky, as the Rutuli, routed in their turn, took to their heels and fled over the field in a cloud of dust. Aeneas was not concerned to slaughter these fugitives, nor did he follow up such as opposed him, foot to foot, or were threatening to shoot at him. Turnus alone was his quarry. For Turnus he peered through the fog of battle, tracking him, calling on him to fight. Shaken by fear of this, the warrior maid Juturna pushed out of Turnus' chariot his driver, Metiscus, who stood with the reins about him. Striking the pole, he fell to the ground and lay far in their wake. Juturna, taking his place and transformed to his likeness, in voice, physique, armor, now handled the rippling reins. Just as a blue-black swallow flits through the villa of some rich lord, weaving a skein of flight in the fine big halls, she gathers up crumbs of food, titbits for her chirruping nestlings. You can hear her twittering, now through the empty colonnades, now by the tanks in the garden. So Juturna went darting amid the foe, her chariot flying all over the battlefield. Now here, now there, she gave them a glimpse of her conquering brother, but allowed no encounter. Next moment she's off and safely away. Aeneas, for all that, followed their mazy trail, determined to meet him. He dogged Turnus through all the confusion of battle, shouting his challenge. Whenever he set eyes on his enemy and tried to outmatch the speed of those galloping horses by running, so often Juturna steered the chariot away at a tangent. What was Aeneas to do? He was at a loss, undecided, with different ideas ebbing and flowing across his mind. Just then Messapus, who carried two whippy javelins, pointed with steel in his left hand. A fighter quick off the mark, poised one, and with unerring aim hurled it straight at Aeneas. He stood his ground, and covering up behind his shield, sank down upon one knee. But the flying javelin took off the peak of his helmet, shearing away the crest from its top. Aeneas then got really angry. His hand had been forced by their treachery. Seeing that Turnus had driven off, well out of reach, he repeatedly called to witness Jove and the altar of the broken treaty, and then at last went in at the foe, with the flood tide of battle behind him, gave rein to the pent-up fury within him, and terribly unleashed a fierce, indiscriminate slaughter. Have I the inspiration now to do justice to so many horrors, to such a gamut of carnage, the deaths of captains driven all over the field by Turnus now, and now by the Trojan prince? Jupiter, was it your will that nations, destined to live at peace for ever, should clash so bitterly? Well, the first combat to hold up the Trojans' assault, though not for long, was when Aeneas met the Rutulian Sucro. Turnus, unhorsing Amicus and also his brother Diores, went for them on foot, nailed one with his long spear as he advanced, struck down with his sword the other, then cut off both their heads, and drove away with those blood-dripping heads attached to his chariot. Aeneas dispatched Talos, Tanais, and the brave Cethegus, all three at one killing, and slew the dejected Onites, a man of Theban stock, his mother's name Peridia. Turnus killed the brothers who'd come from Apollo's land of Lycia, also Menetes, a man who loathed war, but that didn't help him. He was Arcadian, a fisherman living in humble circumstances near the waters of Lerna, a stranger to the mansions of the great, the son of a tenant farmer. You know how it is when fires have been kindled on either side of a wood that is dry as tinder, dense grown with crackling laurel, or when, from the mountain heights, two torrents, foaming in spate, come rapidly roaring down and race towards the sea, leaving behind them a trail of devastation. Aeneas and Turnus tore through the battle with the same violence. Now does an eager of wrath sweep them. Their hearts cannot contain it or imagine defeat. They charge on the enemy's weapons at full power. Moranus, who was sounding off about his ancestors, the whole of his ancient pedigree traced through the kings of Latium, was struck by a rock which Aeneas whirled at him, and sent flying out of his chariot full length on the ground. The wheels rolled him forward under the traces and yoke of his horses, which trampled him down with a flurry of galloping hooves, and no thought for their master's life. Turnus encountered Hyllus charging and yelling out savage war cries. He flung a spear at the man's gold-helmeted head. The weapon pierced the helmet of Hyllus and lodged in his brain. His strong arm did not preserve the bravest of the Arcadians, Cretheus, from Turnus. Nor did his gods protect Cupencus when Aeneas came his way. But he took the cold steel full in the breast, poor fellow. His bronze shield could not arrest the blow. Now the Laurentine plain saw Aeolus perish too, his body sprawling upon the ground, that Aeolus whom all the armies of Greece had never been able to bring down, nor even Achilles, who overthrew the kingdom of Priam. Here he came to the finish. He had a fine home at Lyrnessus under Mount Ida, a fine home, but he sleeps in Laurentine soil. The whole of each army had now been thrown into the battle. All the Latins and Trojans, Nicias and gallant Serestus, Messapus the tamer of horses, brave Asilas, the whole Etruscan division, Evander's Arcadian cavalry squadrons. They struggled, with every man putting all he had into the struggle. No hanging back, no respite. They fought to the death everywhere. Then did his lovely mother put into the head of Aeneas that he should move on the city, divert his men to a sudden assault on its walls, and, surprising the Latins, disorganize and defeat them. Scouring the various battle sectors for Turnus, and looking all round him, this way and that, he viewed the city untouched by all this fighting, peaceful and undisturbed. At once his imagination was lit by the thought of a greater battle. He called up Nicias, Sergestus, and brave Serestus, his staff, and took his stand on a hillock. The rest of the Trojan force gathered to him, tight-packed, but did not ground their shields or spears. Then, standing above the ring of warriors, he said, "I want my orders obeyed instantly. Jupiter's with us. My plan may surprise you, but that must be no excuse for half-heartedness. Look at the city, the cause of this war, the seat of Latinus' power. Unless they admit they are beaten and owe us obedience, this day I'll destroy it and raze its smoking roofs to the ground. Do I have to wait until Turnus feels like facing the ordeal of combat, is willing to meet me again after once being beaten? Here is the heart, the center of this cursed war, my men. Get torches, hurry! Fire shall exact the terms of the treaty." Upon these words, they are all seized by an equal enthusiasm, get into wedge formation, drive solidly at the walls. In a moment, ladders appear, incendiaries the same instant. Some of them run to the several gates, cut down the guards there, while others darken the sky with a covering fire of arrows. Aeneas, in the forward party, stretches his right hand up at the battlements, loudly rebukes Latinus, and calls the gods to witness that once again a fight is forced on him. Twice the Italians have broken a treaty and been the aggressors. The citizens' nervous excitement bursts out into violent dissension. One party demanding the gates be unbarred, the town thrown open to the Trojans, and Latinus himself haled onto the walls. The others took arms and ran to the defense of their city. So, when a shepherd has traced a swarm of bees to their chamber deep in some porous rock, and filled it with acrid smoke, the bees within, alarmed for their community, scurry about the wax castle and raise their temper with high-pitched buzzing. Black, pungent smoke rolls through their cells. The hollow rock is all one inward humming. Smoke trickles out from its crannies. A further calamity now befell the war-weary Latins, shaking the town to its very foundations and causing great grief. The queen, looking forth from her rooftop, saw the advance of the foe, their assault on the walls, the flaming material flung at the houses, but nowhere the Rutuli, no opposition from Turnus. She believed, alas, that her warrior had lost his life in the desperate fighting. The shock and anguish of this unsettled her mind, crying out that she was the cause, she only to blame for disaster, talking wildly, distracted by paroxysms of grief, death in her heart. She tore the crimson gown she was wearing and hung from a beam the noose that would horribly make an end of her. When the poor Latin women got word of this calamity, led by the queen's daughter, who tore at her flower-bright tresses and rose-petal cheeks, they soon were all of them in a frenzy of grief around her. The palace resounded with lamentations. From there the appalling story spread through the city everywhere. All were dismayed. Latinus, rending his clothes, went about in a daze at the tragic end of his wife and his city's downfall, sprinkling upon his grey head handfuls of unclean dust, and censured himself severely for not accepting Aeneas of his own free will, or attaching him to the crown through marriage. Meanwhile, at the far side of the plain, Turnus is fighting, pursuing a few stragglers, but not with such spirit now, with less and less enjoyment in the action of his horses. Borne on the wind, there came to him now an outcry, vague but frightening. He strained his ears. He had to listen. He heard the sound of a city in tumult, a murmur of no good cheer.
O God! What is all that noise coming from the distant city? What has happened to shake the walls with such sounds of grief?
So Turnus spoke, and wild with anxiety reined up his horses, whereat his sister, who, still in the likeness of Metiscus, his charioteer, was controlling the horses and driving the chariot, countered his thoughts by saying, "Let us pursue those Trojans. That way lies the path to immediate victory, Turnus. Others there are to defend the town, and quite competent for it. Aeneas is battling and fully committed against the Italians. Let us deal merciless havoc upon the Trojans here. You'll win as much glory as he, and have no fewer dead to your credit."
Turnus replied, "Sister, I recognized you long ago, the first moment you cleverly caused the pact to be broken, embroiled yourself in this war, and I'm not deceived now by this mortal disguise of yours. But who was it sent you down from Olympus to go through so great an ordeal, to witness the hard death your unfortunate brother must die? For what can I do? What chance or warrant have I of survival? I have seen Murranus, and no one is left whom I love so well, a champion slain by a wound from a champion fighter, fall before my very eyes, calling on me for aid. The ill-starred Ufens died, rather than look upon our dishonour. The Trojans now possess his corpse and his armour. Am I to let our homes be destroyed? The one disaster I have been spared, and not give the lie to Drancy's slanders by fighting? What? Turn my back? My country see me a runaway? Death is not all that dreadful. You shades, be kind to me, since now the powers above have taken their goodwill from me. I shall come down to you, a soul unstained, with no cowardice upon my conscience to make me unworthy of my great ancestors."
He'd barely finished when Sases came racing up on his lathered horse, having ridden right through the enemy, though he was wounded by an arrow full in the face. He cried out to Turnus for aid.
"Turnus, you are our last hope. Pity your people and save them. Aeneas attacks like a thunderbolt, threatens to batter down the citadel of the Italians and blast us with total destruction. Already they're shooting up fire at our roofs. The Latins look to you, pray to you. King Latinus debates with himself, uncertain which alliance to favour and whom to have for Lavinia. And listen, the queen, your most trustworthy supporter, has died by her own hand. She was frightened out of her wits and killed herself. Messapus and gallant Atinas alone, in defense of the gates, are holding our men together. Around them, on flank and front, the hostile formations are pressing a thick-set bristling crop of cold steel, while you're joyriding over these empty fields.
The picture of their changed fortunes struck Turnus dumb, bewildered him. Speechless and staring, he stood there, his heart in a violent conflict, torn by humiliation, by grief shot through with madness, by love's tormenting jealousy and a sense of his own true courage. As soon as the mists parted, and he could think again clearly, he turned his blazing eyes upon the walls, in great distress of mind, looked back at the city there from his chariot. He saw a whirling spire of flame, which was leaping upwards, wave after wave, through the floors of a turret, had got a firm grip on it. Turnus had built this turret himself, a solid construction of planking, with wheels to move on, and gangways rigged aloft. "The fates are too strong for me, sister. I see it now. Don't hold me back. Let me go where God and my own unmerciful fortune call me. I am resolved to fight Aeneas, to bear whatever bitterness death holds for me. You shall not see me disgraced any longer. Just let me indulge this madness of mine ere I die." So saying, Turnus at once leapt down to the ground from his chariot, and leaving his sister sorrowing, dashed through the enemy, ran the gauntlet of fire, his impetus breaking a way through their midst. Even as a boulder that rolls straight down from a mountain summit, dislodged by a gust of wind, a cloudburst has washed away the soil it was fast in, perhaps, or the passage of time has loosened it. Down, with terrific momentum, the huge thing insensately bounces over the ground, steep down, carrying trees, flocks, men before it. Just like this did Turnus speed to the city, scattering the foe from his path, and run to the walls where the earth was most deeply drenched with blood and the air screeched with missiles. He held up his hand as a signal, shouted for all to hear. "Rutuli, put up your weapons. Cease fire, you Latins. Whatever the issue is, I shoulder it. Better that I redeem for you the breaking of the treaty and decide all in a duel." So then they drew apart, leaving a space in the midst for the combat. But Lord Aeneas, as soon as he heard the name of Turnus, hurried away from the walls, from the towers he was then attacking, broke off the whole engagement, impatient of any delay, overjoyed at the prospect of meeting Turnus, and terribly clashed his sword on his shield. Gigantic as Athos he looked, as Eryx, as our own Apennine range when a storm roars in its oak trees dancing their leaves, and its snowy peaks soar joyfully skywards. Now did the Rutuli, the Trojans, and all the Italians excitedly gaze at their two champions, those who were up on the battlements, and those who were thumping the walls below with a ram. All laid down their shields. Latinus himself marveled to see those giants, born in different parts of the world, now met together to fight it out in single combat. They, as soon as the lists were cleared on the open plain, exchanged spear shots from a distance, and then advanced at a run into the fight, and met with a clang of their bronzen shields. Earth groaned beneath the encounter. The sword strokes rained so fast you could not see which hits were lucky and which were skillful. As on the ranges of Scylla, or a plateau of Tiburnus, two bulls charge at each other, head-on, determined to fight to the death. The herdsmen have backed away from the combat in terror, and the whole herd stands mute with fear, the heifers wondering which will be lord of the forest and sultan of all the herd. The two bulls furiously tussle, wounding each other repeatedly, horns straining together and butting, blood running down their necks and shoulders in streams. The woodland rings with their bellowing. Equal to this was the fray between Trojan Aeneas and Turnus of Italy. Shield against shield, they collide with the sound of a thunderclap. Jupiter holds the scales in his own hand. Empty, they balance. And then he puts in the scales the different fates of the two men, to see which weight sinks down, meaning defeat and death. Turnus sprang forward that moment, thinking he saw a safe opening, rose on tiptoe, whirled up his sword, and with all his strength behind it, struck. The Trojans and the excited Latins cried out. Both sides were tense, keyed up. But the treacherous blade snapped. Yes, right in mid-stroke it failed the fiery Turnus, left him no choice but to flee. When he realized he was disarmed, and the sword hilt he held was not even his own, he ran like the wind. The story goes that when he was mounting in haste for battle behind his chariot team, he snatched up the sword of Metiscus, his driver, instead of his father's blade, being blind with excitement. That sword was good enough to deal with the routed Trojans, but it was only a mortal blade. So, when it struck on armor made by the fire god, it shivered to bits at the blow, like brittle ice, and its fragments lay glittering on the brown sand. So Turnus, in desperation, tried this way and that to escape out onto the open plain, running in circles erratically, since all about him the Trojans had formed a ring, and besides a wide-spreading marsh cut off one escape route, the steep walls another. Aeneas pursued the while, though hampered and slowed down at times by the arrow wound he had received in his leg. Still he pressed hard and hotly upon his panting foe. It was like the scene when a hound has got a stag cut off by a river, or headed off by the nets with their crimson feathers which scare it. The hound, baying, follows up close on its heels. The quarry, frightened both by the snares and the river bank's steepness, turns on its tracks again and again. But the spirited staghound sticks to it, jaws agape. Has he got it? You'd think he had got it, the way his teeth snap like a trap. But he's bitten the air and is baffled. Then what a din arose. The riverbanks and the marsh pools echoed and echoed all round. The sky roared with the shouting. Even as he fled, Turnus cursed the Rutulians who stood there, calling on men by their names, demanding they give him his own sword. Aeneas stopped that by threatening immediate death for any who went near Turnus, terrorized the already unnerved Rutulians by swearing he'd wreck their whole city, kept on in spite of his wound. 5 times the pair ran in a circle, then, changing direction, returned on their own tracks. No light-hearted sporting event it was, though, the prize they ran for being the very lifeblood of Turnus. Now it happened a bitter-leafed wild olive, sacred to Faunus, had stood here, a tree from of old held in great reverence by sailors, who, when they'd escaped from drowning, would hang on its boughs their offerings to the Laurentine god, hang up the clothing they'd vowed him. But the Trojans, to clear the arena for the two combatants, had removed the trunk of this tree, with no regard for its sanctity. Here, in the stump, was sticking Aeneas' spear. The momentum of flight had carried it here, and wedged it firm in the tough wood. Aeneas now strained every muscle in an attempt to extract the weapon, wanting to catch with a missile the foe he could not catch up by running. Turnus cried out in extremity of fear,
"Faunus, I beg you, take pity. Dear native earth, hold fast to that spear. Remember how I have always paid you reverence, and how the Trojans profaned you to clear the field for our combat."
This prayer to the god for help did not fall upon deaf ears. Aeneas, though long he struggled, bent over the tough-grained stump, could not by any effort manage to free his spear from the bite of the wood. While he fought and strained with violent exertions, the nymph Juturna, changing again into Metiscus the charioteer, ran forward and gave her brother his own sword. Venus, annoyed that the nymph was granted such freedom of action, approached and tore out the spear from the deep grip of the tree stump. Now in high heart, the two champions, their arms and their spirits restored, one with his trusted sword, one erect and aggressive, holding his spear, stand facing each other, breathing hard, in the lists. Meantime, the king of all-powerful Olympus addresses Juno as she looks down at the combat out of a golden cloud. My wife, how shall it end now? What more is there you can do? For you know, and admit the knowledge, that Aeneas is called of heaven as a national hero, and fate is exalting him to the stars. What are you planning? Why do you linger here in the chill clouds? Was it right that Aeneas, the heaven-born, should be hurt by the hand of a mortal? Or that Juturna should give back the missing sword to her brother? Ah, yes, without you she was powerless. And strengthen the loser's hand? Then yield to my persuasions. Give up the long feud now at last. No more of the hidden rancor that so consumes you, the sullen recriminations your sweet lips have troubled me with so often. This is the end, I say. You had power to harry the Trojans all over lands and seas, to kindle a cursed war, bring tragic disgrace on a king's home, and drape a betrothal in mourning. I forbid you to carry the feud any further. So Jupiter spoke. Juno, the daughter of Saturn, with lowered eyes, replied, It is because your wishes, great consort, were known to me, that I have reluctantly given up Turnus and quit the earth. Otherwise I'd not be sitting apart here, and putting up with every humiliation. No, armed with flame, I'd be there in action, dragging the Trojans into a fatal fight. I admit, I encouraged Juturna to go and help her unfortunate brother, approved of her acting more boldly still to preserve him. But not that she should use her bow and shoot at the Trojans. This I swear by the source of the inexorable river Styx, the one dreadful and binding oath for us heaven-dwellers. And now I do truly yield. I give up the fight. I am sick of it. One thing, and no ruling of fate forbids you to grant it, I do entreat, for Latium's sake and the dignity of your own kin. When they make peace through a prosperous, aye, let it be so, a prosperous marriage, and when they are making agreements and laws to unite them, do not command the indigenous Latins to change their ancient name, to become Trojans, and to be called the Teucrians. Allow them to keep the old language and their traditional dress. Let it be Latium forever, and the kings be Alban kings. Let the line be Roman, the qualities making it great be Italian. Troy's gone. May it be gone in name as well as reality. The creator of man and of all things replied to her with a smile. Jove's sister you are indeed, and the second child of Saturn, so powerful the tides of wrath sweeping within your breast. But come, there was no need for this violent emotion. Calm yourself. Willingly I grant what you ask. You have won me over. The Italians shall keep their native tongue and their old traditions. Their name shall not be altered. The Trojans will but sink down in the mass and be made one with them. I'll add the rites and usage of Trojan worship to theirs. All will be Latins, speaking one tongue. From this blend of Italian and Trojan blood shall arise a people surpassing all men, nay, even the gods in godliness. No other nation on earth will pay such reverence to Juno. The goddess bowed and agreed, glad now to change her whole policy, passed forthwith from the sky, leaving her place in the clouds. This being accomplished, the father brooded a while on another question, how to detach from her brother's side Juturna. Two demon fiends there are, called by the name of Furies, whom darkest night brought forth at one and the same birth with hellish Megaera, breeding all three alike with the twining coils of serpents and giving them wings like the wind. These creatures attend on Jupiter's throne, at the house of heaven's stern ruler, ready to stab fear into the hearts of anguished mortals whenever the king of the gods is dealing out pestilences and hideous death, or affrighting guilty cities with war. Jupiter now sent one of these demons hurrying down from heaven to confront Juturna with a forbidding omen. Off she flew, and swiftly was borne to earth in a whirlwind. Just as an arrow flies through the clouds from a bowstring, a shaft whose tip some Parthian or Cretan archer has doped with a deadly poison and then shot it, fatal the wound it will give, whirring and unsuspected it flies through the murk of the clouds, so sped the spawn of night upon her way to the earth. When she could see the Trojan lines and Turnus' army, she suddenly dwindled and changed into the shape of that small owl which often at night, when no one's about, perches on tombs or gables and hoots for hours disquietingly through the darkness. Thus transformed, the Fury flittered about the face of Turnus, screeching, and kept on bumping his shield with her wings. The thing was so uncanny that he went numb with fear, and his hair stood on end, and the voice died in his throat. But Juturna recognized from afar the creaking wings of the demon. It broke her spirit. She rent her disheveled hair, scratched at her cheeks, and beat her breast in grief for her brother.
"Oh, Turnus! What can your sister do for you now? What worse remains for this much-tried heart? I have used all my powers to save you, but how can I face a manifestation so dreadful? No, no, I give up the fight now. I tremble. Oh, spare me your terrors, you sinister bird. I know the beat of your wings. I know that they sound the tocsin of death, and Jove's high purpose has given these high-handed orders. So thus he requites me who took my virginity. Why did he make me immortal, disfranchise me from the common law of death? But for that, I could end my terrible anguish this very moment and go through the shades with my poor brother. I, immortal! What joy can I have from immortal life, bereft of my brother? Alas, that nowhere may earth yawn deep and let me go down to the ghosts below, for I am a deity."
So saying, the goddess veiled her face in her grey-green mantle, and heavily sighing, vanished into the depths of the river. Aeneas moved up on his enemy, hefting and flashing his spear, which was huge as a tree, and shouted out with extreme ferocity,
"Turnus, you'll get no more reprieves. Are you still recoiling? It's cold steel now, hand to hand, not fleetness of foot that will tell. Try all the transformations of Proteus. Summon up your powers, whether of courage or magic. Take wings, if you like, and shoot straight up to the stars, or go to ground in the deep earth.
Turnus, shaking his head, replied,
It's the gods and Jupiter's enmity frighten me, not your sneers or your bloodthirsty speeches.
Without a word more, he looked round, and his eyes lit on a huge stone, a huge old stone, which for years had been lying there on the plain as a boundary mark between fields, to prevent disputes about ownership. Hardly could 12 strong men of such physique as the earth produces nowadays pick up and carry it on their shoulders. Well, Turnus pounced on it, lifted it, and taking a run to give it more impetus, hurled this stone from his full height at Aeneas. But as he moved, as he ran, as he raised his hands, as he threw that boulder, for him it was just as if somebody else were doing it. Ice-bound were his veins, and his legs felt like water. So, too, the stone he hurled, flying through the empty air, failed to make the distance, fell short of its objective. But, as it is in a nightmare, when sleep's narcotic hand is leaden upon our eyes, we seem to be desperately trying to run and run, but we cannot. For all our efforts, we sink down nerveless. Our usual strength is just not there, and our tongue won't work at all. We can't utter a word or produce one sound. So, with Turnus, each move he bravely attempted to make, the unearthly demon brought it to nothing. Now did his feelings veer this way and that in distraction. He gazed at the city, the Rutuli, faltered with fear, trembled at the weapon menacing him. He could see no way to escape, and no way to get at Aeneas. His chariot, his sister who drove it, were nowhere to be seen. So Turnus faltered. The other brandished his fateful spear, and watching out for an opening, hurled it with all his might from a distance. The noise it made was louder than that of any great stone projected by siege artillery, louder than a meteorite's explosion. The spear flew on its sinister mission of death like a black tornado, and piercing the edge of the sevenfold shield, laid open the corslet of Turnus, low down. Right through his thigh it ripped with a hideous sound. The impact brought giant Turnus down on bent knee to the earth. The Italians sprang to their feet, crying out. The hills all round bayed back their howl of dismay. Far and wide the deep woods echoed it. Turnus, brought low, stretched out a pleading hand, looked up at his foe in appeal.
I know. I've deserved it. I'll not beg life. Yours was the luck. Make the most of it. But if the thought of a father's unhappiness can move you, a father such as you had in Anchises, I ask you, show compassion for aged Daunus, and give me back to him. Or, if that is the way it must be, give back my dead body. You have won. The Italians have seen me beaten, these hands outstretched. Lavinia is yours to wed. Don't carry hatred further.
Aeneas stood over him, poised on the edge of the stroke, but his eyes were restless. He did not strike. And now, What Turnus had said was taking effect, was making him more and more indecisive. When, on his enemy's shoulder, he noticed the fatal baldric, the belt with its glittering